So if you go into that hunt putting too much pressure on yourself about killing an animal, you're going to miss a lot of the subtleties that will just permeate your inner being or your soul throughout your life.
Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. This show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, visit exomountaingear.com. Well, welcome to episode 162 of the Hunt Backcountry podcast, and thanks for joining us. The past couple weeks, Steve and I have been on the road attending shows in Portland and Salt Lake, and we actually got to see many of you and meet many of you there. So if you did swing by, thank you so much for dropping by. It was great to meet so many of you guys in person, and we really appreciate you taking the time to do that and share the feedback about the show and what we're up to, and truly, truly thank you. That's the reason we haven't had an episode out in a bit, just because the schedule with those shows is a bit crazy. As you might still hear in my voice, I'm not quite back to normal in terms of how much we've been talking, and then just kind of having a bug from, being on the road and all that. So anyway, great times, man, the last couple weeks, and excited to get back to regular episodes here. I wanted to remind you guys, the giveaway for this month is with Black Gold Bow Sights. So you can go back to our last Monday Minute episode to hear more about what they're up to in 2019, but their new Pro Sight is pretty unbelievable with how many features they have packed into that, yet at the same time, the simplicity that they've kept. Really cool. I'm really looking forward to shooting one this year. You can win one. So just go to exomountaingear.com/podcast, look for the giveaway link, and get entered there. All right, in this show, we're kicking off a two-part conversation that we had with Billy Malls. Billy has been called the modern-day mountain man. He lives up in Alaska for part of the year for the last 20-plus years, has guided up there for all kinds of species, and has a ton of experience up in Alaska. Steve and I are headed up to Alaska this year for caribou, and we wanted to talk to Billy about that. Somewhat about caribou specifically. We'll get into some specific, tactics for caribou and field judging and the actual nitty-gritty of hunting caribou specifically. But even if caribou is not on your radar, if you just want to learn more about Alaska, this is going to be a great episode. And the next episode, part two, a great episode for you to consider to get up to Alaska one day. And whether that's for caribou or moose or one of the other great species they have to offer, you can certainly take away something from this show. To learn more about Billy and everything he has, including his books and films and all kinds of stuff that he's up to, just go to BillyMallsAdventures.com. You can search Billy Malls and you'll not only find his site, but a bunch of resources and articles and things that he's written. Incredibly, incredibly helpful discussion. Hope you enjoy this one. Let's get right into it. Billy, welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast. Thanks for joining us.
You betcha. Happy to join you.
Yeah, we're excited. Steve, how's it going today, man?
Really good. Yeah, excited to talk to Billy here. I think, talking about caribou in Alaska, it's obviously we're going on that hunt next year, so it's kind of a selfishly excited to learn a few things.
Yeah, for sure. So Billy, just to kind of give listeners context, if you could just introduce yourself and talk about what you're up to, your experience with Alaska, as well as just, the general, I know you put out videos and books and you guide. I mean, you're a super busy guy in the hunting space, but just go ahead and give us kind of that background and context.
Okay. Yeah, I guess who I am. I'm born and raised on a farm in Wisconsin. I still live in Wisconsin to this day. Grew up, like a lot of hunters, just kind of fascinated by nature. Started trapping at a young age. My grandfather was a professional trapper. In addition to being a farmer, he would spend he'd go to northern Wisconsin, spend 6 months out of the winter, build a log cabin, and he'd trap all winter long, come home in the springtime, sell his furs, use that money to buy seed, start a new farming season all over again. So his pictures, his stories, his lifestyle really inspired me. My dad, I was 8 years old, and I basically recall it like it was yesterday. We milked the cows one Saturday morning and threw a rowboat in the back of our truck and a pile of rusty traps and some alder stakes and went to this little creek, Lightning Creek, just 3 miles down the road from my house. We shoved into the slow, sluggish current, and we oared away from the road. And then I saw the road disappear as we rounded the bend. Pretty soon, Henry Hines's house disappeared. The telephone line disappeared. And then I was surrounded by nature. And it was like a lightning bolt moment almost. I just instantly right there, I knew this is how I wanted to live my life. I wanted to live my life in totally remote, untouched places where there's no evidence of man. Something in me came alive. And so my grandpa, we were skinning a beaver one time years later, and he said, if you want outdoor adventure, you need to go to Alaska. So that's where my focus became, and I wanted to hunt in Alaska. I figured I'll never be able to afford to hunt there. I mean, growing up, we never went on vacations. We always had food on the table, but, you know, it was pretty much a hand-to-mouth existence. So I figured, well, if I want to go to Alaska, I'm going to have to make a career out of it and kind of come in the back door to some of these adventures. And long story short, ended up in Alaska and worked as a packer for a couple of years. And now 21 years later, still guiding there, spending anywhere from 80 to 110 days, and 90 to 110, pretty much 100 is about the average anymore now, days out of the year in the bush, guiding in the Brooks Range, Western Alaska, Alaska Peninsula, Kodiak, Southeast Alaska, Central Alaska, kind of guided more or less all over the state except for extreme Southeast Alaska. Yeah, I still love it. And I guess, you know, like a lot of us, our experiences in the wilderness kind of change who we are, or mold our life, or to some degree, you know, our life revolves around largely our experiences in the wilderness, because they're some of the most intimate personal experiences, life-changing events, especially when you're in the wilderness. As the old saying goes, adventure begins when things go wrong, and you experience hardship and difficult times, and you overcome obstacles, and it really changes your perspectives on life. And I'd say that's ultimately who I am, and what the Modern Day Mountain Man brand is about is just the simplicity of life. It's the adventure. I'm not a big guy. I mean, as far as like scores go and all that stuff, it's interesting and it's all good and it's great, you know, resource management. But at the end of the day, I'm more enthralled by what I learn about myself in the wilderness, what I learn about nature, the fact that I'm able to share my passion with other people, the friendships that I make with other guides, pilots, other clients. That's what it's about for me, is just the life experience and the connectivity to God and the understanding of nature. And I went to Alaska. I wanted to shoot a caribou and a moose and a dall sheep, all that stuff. 21 years later, I've never shot a big game animal for myself in Alaska, and probably guided for well over 200, probably closing in on 300 animals in Alaska. So at this point, I really don't have that desire, is really gone, but I still love it. And my time in the wilderness is maybe more valuable than ever now that I'm a father of three. And as I grow older, the ability to go experience the wilderness is every bit as important to me as it's ever been. So I guess that's probably the long version of who I am and what Alaska is to me.
Yeah, that's awesome. So after all these years, you still haven't essentially hunted for yourself then in those 20 plus seasons?
Nope, never even bought a tag. I can't. Wow. I can't afford to hire myself.
That's wild, man. Going back to like your first experience in Alaska, and then tying to listeners as they're hearing this episode, maybe their first experience in Alaska. What are some of the misconceptions about Alaska? What are some of the things that maybe people get wrong about it or don't fully understand? Help us as beginners with Alaska, and maybe tie that back to some of your beginning experiences about really getting up there and experiencing Alaska for what it is and not just what we think it might be?
Ah, that's a really good question. Yeah, pretty simple, but yet probably for me being pretty verbose, probably the ability or has the makings for a long answer, so I'll try to keep it short and concise. But probably the biggest misconception I find is that people have a sense that there's animals everywhere. You know, you hear a lot of, you either hear the horror stories and then you hear the grandiose success stories, right? You don't hear about the doldrums, about the, you know, 3 days of just sitting with the in a storm and the wind slapping you in the face. You don't hear about the 5 days that, you know, you sit on a hill and you don't see an animal. So there's a lot of that. I think Alaskan hunting adventure is the biggest thing that you do is you endure and combat the elements in patient waiting for your opportunity. You know, and it usually comes, provided you're hunting in a, you know, a decent area. Obviously, you hunt a better area, you get more opportunities. You know, that's what it's all about. But no matter where you are, I mean, I didn't think it would be possible where I guide on the Alaska Peninsula to have a guy not kill a big bear. You know, after 17 years of guiding down there, my confidence was really high. This was a few years back. And, you know, it was, in my mind, it was just kind of a sure thing that, you know, you're patient enough, you'll kill a big bear. And I had two brothers that had hunted with me a few times. And I'm like, oh, yeah, this spot that I hunt, will, you guys will both kill big bears. I've never had a client not shoot a bear over 9 foot there. It's a no-brainer. Well, they hunted 10 days, and neither one of them shot a bear. We saw a couple of really big bears, but the salmon spawns were so strong that summer that all the big mature bears were basically nocturnal. And when we did see bears, it was just the first, they're so smart. A brown bear and grizzly bear makes a black bear look like an idiot. They're so intelligent. So if they don't have to feed, they don't. They're just so reclusive naturally, even though there's no people there. So we'd see a couple of big bears 15 minutes into the morning, and then that was it. They'd go into the brush and hide. There's no way you can get them. So they hunted 10 days. One day we saw 35 for sure different bears in one day, but there was no big boars. And they, you know, they wanted to shoot a mature bear. They didn't want to just shoot a bear. So long story short, here you are in the best clay, one of the best, very best brown bear areas in the whole entire state. They hunted 10 days and, you know, they went home without anything. So there's that. It's just that, you know, your nature is a powerful thing. And if you try to fight it, you're going to lose. You know, you can only take what she's going to give you. You know, you can do your best, but beyond that, that's all you can do. So another misconception, so I guess that's number one, is that, you know, it's not all just, you know, there's a herd of 40,000 caribou marching through your camp. That, you know, that stuff rarely happens. The other misconception, or I guess a piece of advice that I kind of tell people, it's maybe a little bit blunt, and I hope it doesn't sound arrogant, but if you want to enjoy your experience, if you go there with the mindset that you have to kill something to come home and feel successful, or if you can't stand the thought, this I guess is the way I put it, maybe in just layman's terms, if you can't stand the thought of going on an Alaskan adventure and coming home without something, if that would be really hard for you to accept, I would say you're not ready to do it yet. Because what happens, because I've seen a lot of hunters with that attitude, and what typically happens, unless things just go swimmingly well and the first day or two they kill an animal, is they will spend their whole time in Alaska worried and frustrated, and their whole mindset is, what if I don't get something? You know, what? This isn't going the way I planned, and then they're not able to enjoy the experience. You know, you're going to one of the most magical places on earth, the last frontier of North America. And so I think you have to go into the mindset that, hey, I'm going to hunt as hard as I can, but even still, there's a chance I'm going to go home without something here, no matter what the booking agent or the transporter or my guide, whatever he's told me, I don't care who it is. There's always a chance things are just going to go completely wrong, and you might come home with nothing but some pictures and some memories. And, you know, after, you know, 21 years, a lot of, like, the kill shots, I don't really remember them, you know, because they're all about the same to me. What I remember about a hunt is, you know, the one caribou hunt where my client fell down in the river and I jumped in to grab him, and there was about 3 seconds there that I thought we were both going to die. You know, the shooting of a caribou at that point doesn't matter, you know, or the guy that's the guy that had two artificial knees, you know, it wasn't really about, you know, shooting the sheep. It was all about his 40 years of wondering if he could actually do it. And he comes to Alaska at the age of 60 and he actually does it. So the killing of the animals, it's a great climax, I guess, but that's really not, it probably most of the time, it's not going to be, in my opinion, it's usually not going to be the thing that you're going to remember about your experience 20 years later. It's going to be the details. And so if you go into that hunt putting too much pressure on yourself about killing an animal, you're going to miss a lot of the subtleties that will just brew or like permeate your inner being or your soul or whatever throughout your life. That's the stuff. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it's good stuff for sure. Yeah.
Okay. So, and I would say probably to connect it to my first experience, I was on Kodiak Island and I was a packer, so kind of a guide in training. Basically, I was a human mule. We were hunting in, Uyak Bay, and we would hike up this, they called it the East Fork, this real long drainage. It was 9 miles to our spike camp, and we hiked up in there with 12 days of food, and we had hip boots on. So it was me, the guide, and the client. And the client was videotaping his whole hunt, and we get up there, and we end up shooting this bear in this ridiculous spot way up in the snow. I didn't have snowshoes, and my hip boots filled with water because the snow, I'd, like, break through the snow to my crotch. The only thing that would stop me from going, you know, all the way to the bottom of the snow, I don't know how deep the snow was my crotch. And so the hip boots would fill with snow. And so they're filled with water. The guide and the hunter, they both had snowshoes. So they were able to walk on top, and I'm sinking through every step. So we get to this bear, and he's bedded on the ledge of this crevasse. And if we shoot him and he falls into the crevasse, the guide knew that he couldn't get into that crevasse. So we sat there and we waited for, like, I don't know, 3-4 hours for the bear to get up. And finally it's dark, and I'm, like, shivering and hypothermic, you know. And finally he realizes, hey, we got to scare this bear up, get him up into this avalanche slide so these snow boulders, if we can shoot the bear, then the bear, if he does roll, he'll get hung up on these snow boulders, which is what we did. So we shot the bear late at night. It was a huge bear. I filmed the hunter shooting. That's what got me started on filming all my hunts, was the fact that that hunter shared all the footage from his experience with my parents later on when I was still in Alaska. He mailed it to my parents, so that inspired me to videotape all my hunts. But I guess where the big first experience for Alaska came from me is in packing that bear hide, which weighed all of 150 pounds. I had a 10-pound rifle, 10-pound pack, probably 10 pounds of my own gear. So the pack was about 180 conservatively. Huge bear. It was 10'8". It was the number 24 Boone and Crockett when it was shot. And we didn't flush it all that well, but the guide I was with, he was kind of anxious to get back to base camp because there was like 10 cases of beer there. So he didn't really want to hang out in spike camp any longer. And so in hiking that thing back, I made it probably about 2/3 of the way. So let's just say, for sake of argument, about 6 miles. And he was in a big hurry because we had a rubber raft, a Zodiac, sitting there on the shore. And he wanted to get there at high tide so we didn't have to drag the Zodiac miles out to get to the ocean with the tide receding. And it was so hard. We crossed the creek so many times. My hip boots are wet. My pack is so heavy, and I'm getting so exhausted climbing these 3 to 5 foot cut banks with 180 pounds on my back and hip boots. And I'm just, in my mind, I'm just thinking,
I can't do it. I can't go 9 miles with this pack. I can't do it. I can't do it. I didn't want to let the guide down, and I'm pushing as hard as I can, but I'm going slowing down. And the guide's pack probably weighed 120, 130 pounds in his own right. But, you know, my job, that was my one and only job, was to get that pack of meat out of the bush, right? And so finally he's just laying, he's sitting down when I catch up to him, and he says, give me your pack. I'm like, no, I can do it. And I knew I couldn't. And so we switched packs, which his pack felt like a feather for about the first, I don't know, 100 yards. And then after that, it was just heavy, stupid heavy too. But that last 3 miles when I was carrying his pack, I'm like, oh, what's he going to tell, you know, my boss? And, you know, I guess if my dream is all for naught, I failed, I can't do it, you know? Well, then we get to the salt water, and the tide's going out, and it's like 300 yards away. So we load the moat. We had to mount the motor because we took that off. So the bears went to the cowling, and we threw the gas in there in survival suits and our heavy packs and the bear hide. So now kind of like a scene out of SEAL training or something, the three of us are carrying this raft and running through the sandy ocean floor trying to get to the receding tide water so we didn't have to wait, you know, 10 hours for it to come back in. And I'm just dying. My legs are burning. And, you know, at that point, I wasn't having fun. The romance of hunting in Alaska just wasn't there. And I'm still wondering if I can even, if I've got the balls and the ability and the strength to handle this job. Long story short, we get the Zodiac, the motor running, and we get to the water and we take off, and we've got about a 5 mile cruise up to our original base camp. And I'm just sitting there looking at the mountains and thinking about my grandpa who told me to come here, and kind of wondering if this is my one and only experience that I'll ever get in Alaska, because I'm not man enough to do this. And about the time I was feeling really, really low is the guide punched me in the thigh, and the guide was a guy of very few words. And he goes, you did pretty damn good. You made it farther than I thought you would. And it was like a million pounds was let, you know, released off my shoulders. And that's what I figured about. That's it. That's what Alaska is all about to me, is you find out who you are and what you're capable of. My best adventures, my greatest stories, the greatest hunts I've ever been on is when I've been pitted against something that was bigger than me. And then I had to dig deep, whether I'm either just, you know, whether that's just growth and I'm, you know, finding what I'm made of, or am I actually, you know, am I growing? Am I becoming a better person? Or is that person in me that I just don't understand it? Whatever the case is, you get into a tough situation and you're the only one that can get yourself out of it. It really helps a person grow. It helps you grow personally, I guess, emotionally, spiritually, physically. It helps you in all aspects of life. And I think that's, for me, that's the most beautiful, wonderful thing about my time in Alaska.
That's awesome, man.
Very well said, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So, as we mentioned, Steve and I are going up with a group with some other guys in 2019 to hunt caribou. A couple of the guys, including Steve, have been to Alaska before, but for several of us, it'll be the first trip to Alaska. Do you think in general that caribou is a good place to start for an Alaskan hunt? I'm just thinking of listeners who are out there and thinking, I got to get to Alaska one day. Would you recommend caribou as a starting place or something else? Or is it, you know, not necessarily the case where you maybe should or shouldn't start with a certain type of species or a certain type of hunt?
Nope, I think you guys are doing it spot on. That's what I tell everybody, is go do a caribou, because that's so unique. I've been on Kodiak. I've guided there for probably about 7 or 8 years. So you could do black-tailed deer without a guide. For those who don't know, to hunt grizzly bear, brown bear, mountain goat, dall sheep, I don't think I'm missing anything there, you would need a guide as a non-resident to hunt them. So you don't need a guide for moose, caribou, black bear, sitka black-tailed deer, wolf, wolverine, muskox. I guess you don't need a guide, but there's very little opportunity for muskox. So I definitely recommend a caribou. You get that, typically you're able to get that Alaskan experience where You experience the vastness, the loneliness, which I think is what makes Alaska unique. So I think you're doing it spot on.
Okay, cool. Can you give us maybe some high-level understanding of caribou? I'm sure that listeners know what they are, but I'm just, for me personally, when I go to hunt a species, I want to know about it. Like, I want to understand the species and not just show up and go, yeah, there's one, let's go shoot it. And so, I've done some research and reading in terms of the basics, but, you know, you read about the different herds in Alaska, and obviously it's, you're hunting at a time when they're in migration, but I haven't really gotten in depth to understand why maybe they're herded the way they are, why they're migrating during that time of the year. Can you just kind of give us some understanding of caribou in general, their behavior, and just help us understand more about them?
Dude, you're going to do pretty well in this podcast business. You ask good questions. I already tell you and I need to share some whiskey sometime. I like
Let's
it.
Do
you
it.
Got a pretty good, you got like the, I don't know, I'm kind of a quasi get half drunk philosopher kind of a guy. I like it. I think that's the mentality. That's it. I mean, that's it. What you're hitting on is what makes me tick. Is if you want to go hunt an animal and you want to do it successfully, you've got to think like the animal. You know, you as a hunter, for me, I've asked myself the question why about 3 trillion times, and that's what's beautiful about it. That's the art of hunting, and it's I call it an art because it's not black and white, right? You're going to learn something all the time. You never have it figured out. But the thing with nature is there's a reason for everything. There's a reason every animal does everything. They're not doing things by emotion. They're doing things because they have a set objective in life and they never stray from that objective. And so the more you can fine tune the animal's objective, which is basically to grow strong and prosperous until it dies so that it can give back the most to nature. That's every organism in nature's goal, purpose for existence. And they never stray from that. So they're pretty simple like that. However, their exact purpose, there's no finite definition. So you're always fine tuning your perception or understanding or belief of what that animal thinks and is doing. So to get to try to answer your question. So a caribou in a herd is completely different from a caribou that is alone. A caribou that is alone, oftentimes, you know, it all depends on what's been going on for them in the last, you know, let's just say maybe a week or maybe a month. You know, if there's a pack of wolves working around and they've been, you know, chased a few times, they're going to be more flighty. If they haven't seen anybody, they'll kind of get a little more complacent, because what they're trying to do is eat and get as strong as they possibly can. They're very lean animals. Their food source, they're not used to ever being real fat and sassy, right? And they got a tough winter. So they're kind of like a deer or an elk in the wintertime. They throw caution into the wind and they go down by the roads because they need food. Their craving for food, it becomes more important than their need for seclusion and protection from predators as they become more hungry. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the caribou, they do the same thing. If they're secure, they're going to be more bold, and if they need the feed, if they're, you know, times are kind of tough, they're going to be less wary, and if they're being pressured less, they're going to be less wary. So if you get a herd of 40 caribou, they know that there's a 1 in 40 chance that a predator is going to kill them. If you have one caribou, there's a 1 in 1 chance that a predator is going to try to kill them. You know, 100% of the time, if there's a predator, you can bet, you know, not well, a wolf isn't gonna chase after him every time. But as far as the caribou is concerned, if he's all alone and he sees a wolf, he's going to be pretty darn skittish, and he's going to be very nervous. So you get a herd of 700. So me and a hunter, we come out of the sheep mountains, and he has a caribou tag. And there's a herd of 700 caribou walking downstream, and they're strung out over a course of a mile and a half. The big bulls, of course, they're in the back. You know, they want everybody else to go through the danger zone before they do. And so what we did is we basically had to get in front of the herd, and we kind of, like, for lack of better terms, waded through about 650 caribou before we could get to the big bull. How did we do that? We would just sit down, and the caribou would pass 10 yards past us, and they'd be nervous, and they'd see us moving. They knew we weren't right, but because there was so many there, they weren't nearly as flighty as they would have been had there been, you know, 20 or 30 or maybe even 100. But they had that strength in numbers. That's why they cling in herds. Is if one caribou walks past a wolf, that one caribou is very likely to get chased by that wolf. If there's a herd of 700, one caribou, really, only one is probably going to get killed. You know, even if it's a pack, they're going to pick on one. They might, you know, kind of, they'll go after the whole herd, but ultimately it's the one that makes the mistake that the entire pack is going to try to kill. So those caribou know that. So they can let their guard down because they need to feed. Their need for nutrition is so strong, and they never stop moving because they don't want to be a sitting duck for their predators. So they're burning a lot of calories. That said, they basically, when they're up on their feet, they're feeding, you know? So for us to shoot that big bull, it was just, you know, at that point for me, probably 13 years of caribou experience that gave me the confidence to do approach the herd the way I did, is we would just kind of watch the big bull in the back as the caribou are basically filtering past us, and we would just slowly move, usually laterally is really all we moved. The valley was about 2 miles wide, and, you know, the bulls are kind of zigzagging back and forth, and so anytime the caribou around us would get nervous, we would just sit down, let those caribou pass, and then just slowly maneuver a little bit. And, you know, the whole herd was really quite calm. Had we had one caribou really blown, had we been too aggressive, then, you know, one of the caribou would probably bolted, and then potentially the whole herd, you know, would have bolted, obviously. But just by the art of hunting probably boils down to the art of patience and aggression. And so we just tried to balance that out. Long story short, the bull walked, I don't know, 80 yards, 100 yards maybe, and the guy shot it with a rifle. You know, it was a real big bull, but, you know, that was the key to the hunt for me, or the experience was, we learned so much about the dynamic of a caribou herd in that experience. That's something I'll never forget, and it's made me a much better hunter because I actually, you know, hypothesized that it would work, and it did. Hmm. So that's a good look, I guess, at the herd dynamic of why they do what they do, and knowing that helps you as a hunter. So I guess the point of it is, the more caribou there are, the more aggressive you can be, and the more aggressive you should be. The fewer caribou there are, the less aggressive you should be. So like if there's one or very few caribou, you know, just getting in close to where they see you, and if they do spot you, then you can just hold up a white bag. A lot of times that'll work. You know, they'll be curious enough, and they recognize, oh, that's probably another caribou. If I joined up with him, I'd have a little bit more security. So sometimes that'll work. So, yeah, there's a lot of dynamics. I certainly don't understand them all. I'm still figuring it out, but that's probably, those are the main ones, is just understanding the herd dynamic as you're hunting them is pretty key.
Yeah, man, there's so much in there I want to come back to. I'm curious, throughout the hunting season, does the herd dynamic change? So is the herd getting larger as the season progresses, or are there any other differences you'd highlight in terms of, say, hunting mid-August versus hunting mid-September?
Yeah, weather, you know, weather is a big factor. Every year is different. I dare say, you know, the travel patterns and migrations, if you will, you know, usually when people talk about the great migrations of caribou, that's generally in the spring when they're calving. Definitely can be in the summer, definitely can be in the fall. I guess in my experience, the bulls early, let's say in August, late July, into August, and let's say to the latter part of August, I won't say the end and into September, but up till the latter part of August, generally it's young bulls, cows and calves are in herds together. For the most part, there's definitely exceptions to that. I mean, it's, you'll see big bulls with cows and calves too, but oftentimes for, it all depends where you're hunting, I guess, but as far as what you're going to see in your area, what's going to be best that time of year. But usually as it gets later into the season, beginning in the latter part of August, and all of my caribou hunting experience has been in the north side of the Brooks Range, is that you'll get the larger bulls will start joining with the herds sometime late August, early September. It's been happening oftentimes where I'll hunt 30 days, let's say, and I'm in caribou country, whether I'm hunting caribou the whole 30 days, I usually don't do that. It's more of an additional species on a grizzly hunt or a sheep hunt, but oftentimes we'll be seeing caribou throughout the season. Is I might hunt 30 days, see, let's say, 5,000 caribou, and I'll see a band of 6 or 7 bulls, or maybe 15 bulls, probably 6 or 7 in this case would probably be more realistic. And it'll be in that band will be the 6 or 7 biggest bulls I've seen all year in comparison to all 5,000. The 5 biggest I've seen are in that one herd. All 5 of them will be the biggest ones I've seen. So there's some of that, those big bulls. And I think, I guess I haven't seen that. I've seen that a little bit with elk in the Rocky Mountains. I'm sure there's other animals that'll do that. I've seen it a little bit with bull moose, but more so with caribou. If you see exceptionally big bulls, you know, let's say you get landed in a spot and you're seeing a lot of big, big bulls, that's, I don't know, for some reason they seem to kind of congregate together like that. That's just one of the anomalies that I've noticed from caribou versus other animals. They kind of oftentimes run together now come late September into October into the rut. You know, obviously I'm sure those big bulls are, those bachelor groups obviously are splitting up and they're going elsewhere and joining different herds of cows and breeding, but that time of year oftentimes those biggest, oldest, mature bulls are together.
Yeah, that is interesting. Hopefully we get landed in the spot where all the big bulls are then.
Yeah, well, and that's one thing to watch for that I would say is a fairly common mistake, I guess, if you want to call it a mistake. But a lot of guys, they'll see a herd of 300 caribou. Well, if you haven't looked at a lot of caribou, if you see 300 caribou and there's, you know, 20 bulls in the group, kind of just human instinct or human nature, you're going to kind of think that, well, boy, that's the biggest out of 300. It must be a pretty big one. But that's often not the case. It might be the biggest out of 300, but it might be, you know, a 3.5-year-old bull, and it's quite small, and you shoot it. And like I say, here over the hill comes 30 bulls, and every one of them is twice as big as the one you just shot. So really studying, having a good idea of what a trophy bull caribou looks like, that's pretty key for the do-it-yourselfer, particularly your first time or two out. So it's hard to be objective if you heard, and you might see a herd of 500 or 600, and there's no big bulls in the group. But to be able to know that, hey, that's not a big bull, even though it's the biggest out of 500, it's still not big.
Do you have general guidelines for sizing them up?
You know, I'm not a. I do, and I'll share whatever I know, but I'm not a. I'm more of a. Just, I don't have a lot of just real set criteria, I guess, maybe because I've never taught somebody, I guess. Uh-huh. This year, had a packer, a good young packer, working with me with sheep hunting. And he was real young, easy to, or wasn't that young. I guess he was young to me. He's 3 years younger than I was, so I consider him young. But he was hard work and real eager. So I found myself teaching him. And as they say, if you want to learn something, you teach it. And so for the first time I was ever really giving somebody as detailed lessons or teaching as I possibly could. And I really found that I learned a lot in teaching him. But I guess for caribou, I just kind of look at them. And I, at this point, after 20 years, you know, probably be like whatever animals you guys hunt the most, you probably don't even know how or why you would say something about an animal or how or why you would approach an animal a certain way. You just know it because you've done it enough.
Yeah.
So that's kind of how it is for me. But so don't take this as gospel. Is look for our caribou in the Brooks Range are fairly small in the north there. But you look for a rack that's as high as the caribou is tall. The biggest thing is you look for a sweeping curve of the main beam of the antler. And if you see the main beam, if it's as tall as the caribou is, if the rack overall is as tall as the caribou is, and the antler swoops back, and then the main beam comes up and goes flat, that's a pretty good sign. And if you see the main beam start to grow down towards in front of the nose, that's a very, very good sign. You probably have a very mature bull at that point, you know, assuming that you have good mass, brows, bezes, all that stuff, good top point, then you're looking at a giant. And if he's, I look for a trophy caribou, I look for a body and a half in spread. And also the first thing I key in on, if you see a herd of caribou, is look for the whitest caribou there is. That's usually going to be your oldest bull, or one of the older bulls.
Yeah. One thing you mentioned there that I thought was, so I went up on south side of the Brooks Range last year, and we were shocked once we both killed bulls how small they were. I mean, they were essentially big mule deer. So that is a smaller kind of species of them up there versus other parts of Alaska.
Yeah, you get down like on the Alaska Peninsula. I've heard guys say they're 600-700 pounds. I've seen them down there when I'm bear hunting, but I've never been down there in the fall. We are just able to start hunting them again here, I guess last year or the year before. I don't just remember. I haven't personally hunted them down there, but they're much bigger bodied down there. And that interests me because I know there's a reason for that. You know, whether that's just a food value or what it is, but obviously in the Arctic, a little bit drier, where I think those, I'm guessing it has something to do with the moisture of air down on the Alaska Peninsula by the Bering Sea. I'm guessing they have to be a little bit bigger in body size. It must serve them. They've adapted to be a little bit bigger in body size that they're able to survive in that damper climate or something in their food, the reason why they're bigger. But it's my understanding, and I would say it's probably roughly true, close to being true if it's not exactly, but I would say the caribou down there are darn near twice the size of the ones up in the Brooks.
Okay, so, wow, yeah. And so we glassed them for 5 days, and then we finally kill one, and you're standing over the top of it and going, holy cow, these things are kind of small. At least it's definitely just a big mule deer.
Yeah, and that's one reason why it's easy to get fooled on their antlers. You know, you look at the antlers in proportion to the body, and they look really impressive. You walk up to them, and you scratch your head a little bit. So brown trout, nothing new for any hunter, but, yeah, you go on that trip. You want to be as informed as you can be on what you're shooting. So
yeah.
So just as a general tactic, Billy, in terms of you mentioned caribou are often moving, even if they're feeding, they're moving. So is it generally better when you spot a group of caribou to try and anticipate their direction and get ahead of them versus just chase them direct on and kind of play that cat and mouse game of they're moving, you're moving, and essentially go for more of a cutoff approach?
Absolutely. Yep. The caribou that you've been seeing, you should be studying them and watching landmarks where they're going even the smaller caribou, you know, the day that you arrive, you know, just kind of glass, look for a couple of bulls, probably primarily try to identify a few characteristics of them. Let's say if you got some particularly a big bull or some funky antlered bull, right? So then you wake up the next morning, okay, are those bulls still around? Then you get a pretty good idea of what the herd is doing. You know, sometimes the herd will be comfortable in an area and they're just kind of milling around. You know, they're not, they're never sitting still, but they're not really, they're not migrating, if you will, or, you know, just passing through. Or you wake up in the morning and everything's new and clearly the caribou are marching past. You know, look at those landmarks that they seem to be going past the most, because the other caribou are going to smell that same trail and they're going to recognize that. It's going to give them security to know that, hey, this is a safe passage route. Oftentimes, they'll use those same routes as the caribou in front of them. So certainly, most of the time, I would say most of the time, you're cutting them off to some degree. You know, you're getting in front of them. It's not often that they're just staying put. It's less likely that they're just kind of staying in an area, unless they're real close. Let's say they're within a mile of you. Yeah, then, you know, if they're moving slow, you can more or less just stalk them and know they're going to be close. But if a caribou is a couple of miles away, you for sure, no matter how fast he's moving, you've probably got to anticipate the general direction of flow of where the herd is generally flowing. And there usually is a pretty noticeable direction that they're moving, usually. If you're in the mountains, a lot of times the caribou will be more secure and they won't move around as much. But if you're out in the open tundra, they're usually moving. Sometimes if you're on the edge of the mountain, they might, especially early in the season if bugs are bad, they'll cling up into the mountains during the day or a pack of ice, and they'll lay on that to get away from the bugs. And then in the evening, if it cools off, then they'll spill out, you know, kind of like a herd of elk. Then they'll spill out into the tundra flats, and then they'll go back first thing in the morning to the mountains. So every scenario, I guess that's another one of the beauties, is every scenario is just a little bit different. But the one thing that I would say is don't ever try to catch a moving relative, because if they're feeding, if they're like basically walking and feeding, they're probably going 4 to 5 miles an hour, which in the tundra for a human is basically impossible to sustain. So I always kind of go, I would say like 2 miles. If they're kind of angling some direction toward me, if they're within 2 miles and I think I've got a shot, that's probably about a good cutoff. If they're any farther than 2 miles and they're, you know, more or less angling away from you and you believe their direction of travel will continue away from you, you're better off not even trying. Just stay put where you're at and hope another herd comes by, or otherwise 6 hours later, you'll still be chasing that herd and you'll look back by your tent and there's a big bull caribou standing there. It's about all that usually stand up. So, yeah, it's just an educated guess is all it is. So okay. I think you're going to get more information by, you know, your whatever caribou you see before you're planting that stock than what I could probably give you, other than just, you know, you just got to trust your instinct at that point. But it's all over the map. But yes, usually you're going to be cutting them off. So
I was talking to a buddy the other day about caribou hunting, and based off my experience, he's a big salmon fisherman, and I was like, just any caribou that is it in front of you that is like you're not glassing coming towards you 2 miles away, just consider a fish that swam by you. Like you can't go get it. You're pretty so well.
Yeah. Basically, yeah, absolutely. If they're moving, if they're in a moving mindset, don't even bother. Yeah.
Yeah.
What is your preferred glassing setup for caribou, Billy?
Just get somewhere fairly close to camp. I mean, I usually don't stray far. I just get an 8x10 tarp or 10x10 or whatever and have some sort of shelter. And, I'm usually you're in fairly open country, so I don't ever use like a spotting scope, rest the binoculars on it, especially up in the Arctic where I hunt. They're either there for God and everybody to see or they're not there.
You know, it's not like a hunting a early season mule deer where you got a bighorn sheep where you're trying to pick apart every bush. It's nothing like that. So basically just some binoculars and a decent spotting scope to have an idea what you're working with. But unless you're hunting some rolling terrain, I find that you're better off just kind of staying put in one spot and get a good feel for what the animals are doing in your area. You know, if you go to a new knob or hill every day and you're looking at new country, well, that's good. You know, if the caribou you see are really just hanging in an area, you know, if they're just hanging in little pockets, which is pretty rare for caribou, yeah, then it probably behooves you to go check different basins that might be around. But otherwise, just find your best vantage point close to camp and just sit there and watch and wait for the right opportunity. And you figure you got a good chance, you go like mad and hopefully it works out.
Yeah. How much does it's just difficult for me to associate, you know, thinking of like experienced elk hunting, for example, and making an approach on a bull versus being in this more open country, dealing with this larger herd, a greater distance, and then making an approach on, you know, herd that you might have glassed up. How much does wind factor into how you make an approach, or if you make an approach into a herd of caribou that you've maybe glassed?
Oh yeah, you definitely got to watch the wind. They'll wind you from a long ways off. So, I would say, you know, in a big herd like that herd of 700, I mean, we were surrounded by the herd, and they never, you know, none of them ever boogered, and they certainly will blow out when they smell you. But I think there again, that was just one of those things with that bigger herd. They threw caution into the wind because they saw, hey, the chances of me getting killed are so small right now, I'm not even going to worry about it. I'm just going to feed. So if you have a small herd, definitely you got to watch the wind. I would say they're sometimes they're not that wary of it. It's kind of strange. A lot of times I always say a first-time caribou hunter in many situations is better than a guy that's hunted them for 30 years of his life. The thing with a caribou is they're so unpredictable. They're so dependent on a herd, and I don't even think they totally understand the herd dynamic, because sometimes one caribou will just fart or snort or something and the whole thing will blow up. Other times, you know, you'll be by one or you'll shoot one and the herd basically will startle, and 3 seconds later, every caribou that's still surviving just goes right back to feeding. So they're very, very unpredictable. So you kind of got to expect anything and everything. And they're pretty hard to put a pin down as far as, you know, what will work and what won't work. So if you think you got a chance in caribou hunting, you know, basically don't ever chase one. But if you think you've got a chance in caribou hunting, go for it. That's probably the best piece of advice. And one other thing I will say is if you have a caribou, like a herd that's working towards you, I've had this happen many times, is you'll see caribou, everybody that's hunted caribou for any length of time has had this happen. They'll be working towards you. You'll see them 5-6 miles away and they're headed right to you, right? And you sit there and wait, and they'll walk 5 miles right to you. They're still a mile away. And then all of a sudden they'll turn around. The wind won't have changed. Seemingly nothing has changed. They'll just turn around and they'll go right back the way they came. So, you know, usually in a situation like that, if I see caribou that are working to me, you know, a lot of times I'll just slowly kind of work towards them to try to eliminate that, because I have had that happen a lot of times. If they're moving slow, particularly, don't count on them always moving slow, and definitely don't count on them just continuing right to you. My advice would be in that situation, let's say they're moving at 2 miles an hour feeding, probably just start working in, be cautious, but kind of work towards them. Don't allow too much time to wait for them, because they'll change their mind so often.
Good stuff. What advice do you have as you've closed that distance for then kind of getting into that final, and obviously this is dependent on what somebody feels comfortable with in terms of shot distance and things like that, but the final approach, the final aspect of getting into shooting position, what comes to mind there in terms of advice that you would offer, or maybe some areas where you see people, you know, mess up a situation in that last little bit?
Okay. Yeah. I guess one thing I do, whether it's right or wrong, but I find I'm more particular about it as I go along. And again, this is kind of like one of those things where in my mind and my gut, I know it's best, but I can't like definitively point maybe necessarily as to why. I guess I've just over the years, just these small little nuances have kind of added up and made my belief strong in this aspect is I think shooting sticks are basically the dumbest thing to be carrying around in the field for something like that. I just, unless you're really savvy with them and you know you're just really experienced with them and it's an extension of what you do, don't bother with those. Probably assume that you're going to be shooting from a seated position. Most people don't have a problem getting prone, you know, most people are relatively comfortable with that. But kind of be prepared to be in a shooting position, a sitting position when you shoot, and use your pack. I guess you guys know more about pack than I do, but I usually have hunters. That's the first thing that I do is I get them into camp before we can hunt the day they fly in. I set them up on their pack and teach them how to shoot off of a pack. Teach them, don't hold your rifle and set it on the pack. Hold your pack and set your rifle, you know, maybe in the crook of your thumb and your pointer finger, because when you shoot, this is the biggest thing. This is the biggest thing that I've had go wrong in guys shooting almost anything, but particularly shooting from a seated position, which is 75% of the shots on caribou in the open tundra, is they shoot, and then they, if they're holding their gun, they raise the gun up to throw in another round. Well, then the pack, their rest, falls to the ground. And so they just lost their rest for every shot after that. So that's one big thing. Another one is, as soon as the caribou are alerted to your presence, and, you know, a lot of times I'll be pretty aggressive in the stock if I'm, let's say I'm 200 yards or 300 yards, let's say, you know, and you want to get as close as you can. You figure you're within shooting distance, probably get as close as you can. And as soon as one of them spots you or is alerted or you kind of know you're going to get busted or spotted, don't set up until then if you're at all concerned about the distance you're shooting, because usually they'll give you time, you know, probably more so than a lot of animals. If you're concerned about them banding together, if they're in a big group, that's a big one. I've had caribou get away on a deal like that, is they're banded too tightly together to get a clear shot. So that's another thing you have to take into consideration. You're in a big herd and the bull you're after, and you know, you're farther than what you'd like to be, but you're confident you can make the shot. If that one bull that you're after is in the open, you know, I would probably opt to, you know, if you're concerned, if the herd's large enough and they're banded tightly together where there's a chance that, you know, you won't be able to take a shot if he's too close to others, I would probably opt for a longer shot if he's in the open. So, yeah, I mean, a lot of it's just common sense, but you know, the more prepared and the better idea you have of what should be done and the movements and habits of the caribou, better chances you have, obviously.
Well, that's a wrap for now. We'll be back next week with part two with Billy. In the meantime, make sure you go to exomountgear.com/podcast and enter that black gold giveaway. If you haven't yet, hit the subscribe button so that you make sure and receive future episodes as soon as they are released. We'll catch you next week.